So there's a lot going on. I use that line frequently. I use it with the stuff of personal and family life, like when I've got several doctor's appointments lined up, Denise is mad at me, or I imagine she is. The adult children are fighting, and did I mention that someone's dog looked at me in the wrong way? There's a lot going on. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Okay, joking aside, some of us truly have reason to use that phrase. There's a relationship that's breaking up. There's been a troubling diagnosis, or a family member has mentioned suicide, and we're afraid. Increasingly, I'm hearing it used by people who tend to use more exacting language, like journalists, like historians, as they give up trying to find an appropriate headline and just try to summarize the welter of events cascading through the headlines. Church, and we wonder, is there some space, maybe a Eucharist service, where I can put all of that aside? Apparently not. Is there some spiritual Switzerland? This is for you, Zita. Is there some spiritual Switzerland? This is what a friend mentioned to me once, where there isn't the increasing sense that we're all caught up in some maelstrom, buffeted by forces outside of our control. We may have been momentarily buoyed up by the two readings we just heard. But surface impressions aside, when we look more closely at the first reading, the psalm, we read amidst the joy, the dreaming, the language of great things, that there are phrases like "sow in tears" and "go out weeping." And so we're aware that even in the midst of the language of joy, that stuff has happened. Indeed, the nation has been brought to the brink of extinction, brought in chains into exile, an entire nation treated like the migrants who are being disappeared in the headlines without any compassion or care. What we don't see when we turn to the gospel reading, this beautiful vignette of Mary's gratitude and adoration, are voices and verses just outside the frame, if you will, that threaten violence, both to Jesus, towards Jesus, and towards Lazarus, who has been raised. It's one of those instances of no good deed goes unpunished. Jesus' greatest sign thus far only serving to raise the threat level. Even supreme acts of goodness, spiritual instances of God's partnership with human possibility, do not lead us to a spiritual Switzerland. Biblical wisdom, as well as historical insight, allows us to say that in every epoch, indeed in every tribe and in every nation, for every person, there's always a lot going on. Certain scholars have noted that John's gospel seems to have a question running throughout the different stories and sayings. How might we yet live into joy in the midst of all that is going on? Now, even to ask that question isn't to try to find some escape route. Even asking the question exposes the fact that humans are capable of living into a wide variety of futures, many of which don't promise joy. And John's gospel highlights a few of these, the attitudes of the religious leaders, who because of Jesus' success don't choose joy, they choose resentment. They resent how he destabilizes their political control. They can't corrupt him into their way of doing things, into the machine, if you will. And so murder begins to machinate in their hearts. But John's gospel, this most mystical of texts, isn't really interested in the question with reference to those who are opposed to Jesus. It knows where they stand. But for those of us who are with him, those of us who would say, we're for Jesus, we're with him on the way, thus our story today. In response to Jesus' remarkable sign of the raising of Lazarus, the family throws a dinner party. And Mary, Lazarus' brother, takes very expensive perfume, so valuable that it would have taken a year's wages for an ordinary person. So it's really an investment piece, if you will. They're one of the ways that they could invest for later on. Perfume, and there were a few other things, of course, like precious metals. And she takes this investment and she breaks it open and pours it over Jesus' feet and then wipes those feet with her hair. For the second week in a row, we're invited into a scene of lavish wastefulness. Last week it was kill the fatted calf for the son who has blown the family inheritance. This week, a pound of nard, pure nard. And John makes sure to capture the intimacy of the act, her loose hair wiping Jesus' feet, the sensuality of the smell permeating every nook and cranny of the house. At one level, it's an act of gratitude, and it's understandable. But on the other hand, okay, what an over-the-top diva, right? I mean, wasn't the special meal they had put on for Jesus and his disciples enough? And so we get Judas's reaction. Why wasn't this perfume sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor? I mean, that comment highlights what my reaction would have been. Just as I, on my own, identify with the elder brother in the parable we looked at last week, so here I identify with Judas. I think of the 100 projects, social justice applications, educational opportunities, all the good that could be done with the equivalent of 1 year's salary. Here we need to do a little bit of historical critical work. And I don't bring it up lightly because it takes away John's unfortunate comment that Judas was a thief doesn't square with the rationale that Judas has just offered. It's a red herring. John's description of Judas has indeed fed into ongoing tropes of anti-Semitism in the centuries that have followed. But it's one of those incredibly important things to note that John himself is on the way to embracing the attitudes he's advocating, but he hasn't arrived yet. He doesn't know yet how to break out of the binary that he is addressing. John would have been more accurate and more in tune with the other gospels if he hadn't linked the rationale to Judas alone, but to the group of the disciples as a whole, which he often does, actually, in the rest of his gospel. It's the gospel of the group, if you will. Because I would think that's probably what they were all thinking. Just like it's probably what most of us are thinking here this morning. We don't have to be thieves to identify with Judas's understanding. It's bred in the bone of neoliberal capitalism. Money should be used wisely, prudently. It's always a virtue to be cheap. I'm proud when I'm not wasting money. That's how I was raised. I'm not bragging, I'm just confessing. In spite of that confession, I maintain that there's a lot to be said for Judas's take on the situation. But, and I think this is the point that John is trying to make, though awkwardly, we need to be careful for what Judas, and by Judas I mean the disciples writ large, does here is what we often do. We imagine that the way forward is one of utilitarian calculation, as if simply living frugally or calculatingly will lead us to joy. It won't. It can't. Because it betrays our sense that we can somehow find a foolproof way to live amidst all that is going on and come out on the other end unscathed. But even our best laid plans, we know, will go the way of the grass. They will wither. They will fade. And so Mary shows us a better way. Gratitude that leads to extravagant commitment to Christ. To live into the joy of God's presence with us in the midst of threat. In the midst of all that's going on. To know joy. Live into wonder. She's in wonder of what has happened to Lazarus. And as that wonder reveals itself, it will also lead us towards extravagant commitment. Take that path. Take that risk. Is John's message. And so we, too, this morning are called to ask ourselves, in light of this extraordinary presence of God in the world, in the person of Jesus, what fear, what shrewd prudence is stopping me from taking the risk that I know I will regret not taking when my time is up? When I was 30, my mentor, theological mentor, asked me, what three things would I regret not doing, not taking the time for when I was 60? I knew what they were instantly. It's not important that I tell you what those things were for me. It's important that you know what they are for you if you're under 60, by the way. If you're under 60, it's a great question. If you're over 60, are you just here playing out the string? Or are you still on that path towards joy into the midst of a lot going on? I'm betting Mary never regretted her act of adoration. In my anecdotal experience, beside bedsides of people who are dying, the only thing we regret at the end of the day is not to have expressed our love, not to demonstrate our love. And it is love that will overcome a calculating attitude. It is love, actually, that can integrate the wisdom in what Judas advocates from a different perspective. It is love that will gently remind us that there is not a place where there isn't a lot going on. And it is love that will draw us together and craft a way to express that love practically to those in need, to the poor who are always with us. In the name of Christ, amen.